Zunga Namda zirrim zirce zirce de dingzim bam erilim gibi. Sirim zirrim namye çıkın sağ tüm zirrim gün rola zan sağ. Rokan çizim zonun bacın lüzum bir cübe çizim gün. Cervi yap da çorcan cerciz. Mabesin gittim ilo düzo.
O ya da ne bacıya bari kebala. Çü ninan korbi çü diye bari kebala. Chunyi nyangyi lin dhe pa jye pari khe pa nyi le Thangbo la Dom dhe tenpa tang so sor khe pa nyi le Namba drugi chuta la njukpa la namme bati. Chinyi tang na drupa tang jikda tade mayinkin. Nene tumung tumung me zong dan zimbar mawa ne me la rabdun jubbe so iki sawa songte. Tangbo am tumar
What that means is that we have had the, what is called the chidun of the text pointed out. The chidun means the general meaning or the main idea of the text we've had presented in that whole section that we heard yesterday. And there's one verse in that section that includes the whole idea. So maybe we could look at that one again just briefly. In case it's a little bit unclear, it might help to hear it again. So that's the verse on page 2 at the top, Roman numeral 2. Here the traits of phenomena are defined as duality and equivalent formulation, the appearance of which is mistaken interpretation. Since what appears is not, it could not be true. No reference have ever existed either, and being but concept consist in interpretation. So, very briefly, what is defined as samsara is the process called here phenomena. And that process has two main parts. The first is called duality. And what that refers to is the way things appear. The fact that things appear to us in a dualistic fashion, as if there is a perceived object separate from the perceiving subject. That's just the way things look to us. That's the way they appear. So you take that as a fact. That's the first fact. Then, in order to talk about these as phenomena or as samsara, you have to put on the next part of it. Jitar ngunpara jirpa in the Tibetan is the equivalent formulation. So having that appearance of the dualistic situation, one assumes that it is like that. One assumes that the dualistic appearance has genuine reality equivalent to the way that it appears. And because of that assumption, one then names it. One names the object experienced. And having put on the name, one then mixes the name and the object. So if we, for example, say book, the object to which the word refers and the word have melted together so strongly that we don't need the book itself to talk about book. We can just use the sound. And it for us it refers to the same thing. The name and the object are melted together. So that's the process of formulation. Both of those are appearances. The appearance of the dualistic situation, for example, a form, a sound, smell, taste, or touch, or thought, is the one appearance. The other is having assumed that one to be real, then the terms that you put onto it is another appearance. It's a reinforced appearance of the appearance. So the messiness of samsara starts to shine through this, that one complicates one confuses oneself with a double appearance. Every time you have connection with anything at all, it's a double appearance. You're not only working with the actual sensory experience, but also with your name, meaning your whole concept about it. The name carries with it your whole idea of it. So you work always working through the filter of your own idea of what you're experiencing. So what kind of appearance is that? Is it correct or what? The appearance is mistaken interpretation or incorrect thinking. Why is it incorrect? What is wrong? Since what appears does not exist, it could not be true. So the very thing that is appearing before one's eyes does not exist. The very sound, the very smell, the very taste, and so on, is something non-existent appearing. And since it does not exist, while it's appearing, it could not be true as a thing. It doesn't exist objectively. Then one might think, well, if the object as such does not exist, what about the language we use? It must be referring to something. No, there's no referent for the language we use. The words do not refer to something. No referents have ever existed either, and the being but concept consists in interpretation. So the referent, what we think when we say book, is something in our thought. The referent for the word book is to be found in our thought, not anywhere else. So no referent has existed as such either, but is just a thought, and therefore the whole process of samsara is just a way of thinking. So that's the definition of phenomenon. So maybe we could sing that through in English now. First in Tibetan, because now we just studied in Tibetan, so I think maybe everyone here now knows the Tibetan. De lo chi chi tse ni 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 lan chi ta ngen ju han na since was
not, it could not be true. No reference have ever existed either. And being that concept consisted
So today, then, we go on to the expanded explanation of phenomena and pure being, starting with phenomena. And this is introduced in a verse which reads as follows: because it provides a thorough introduction to their characteristics as well as their rationale, and neither being the same nor different, the ground in common and not in common shared, and the lack of appearance involving perceiver perceived, this six-point approach to phenomena is the best. So then Rinpoche read through the commentary on that and added his own commentary. So I'll try to include what he said in what I'll be saying. And he started by giving the outline for it. And the outline brings us to the second point. The first one was the brief presentation. Second one is the expanded explanation. And the expanded explanation of phenomena is given first in form of headings, very briefly, and then each of them is explained separately. Then the first three of the points we have already had explained. So those are only named very briefly. Then the last three points are explained here. So there's a six-point introduction to the whole subject of phenomena in order to make it very clear to us. And this six-point introduction is said to be unsurpassable, or the best. And the reason why it is said to be best is that through these 6 points, one will be able to gain complete certainty about phenomena. And that is to say that these are the 6 points that should guide one's listening and reflecting. So listening and reflecting are the words that describe the whole process of study, that one does it in connection with those who already received these teachings in the tradition, and therefore it's listening, it's a live process, not to be gotten just from books. And having listened, then if one does not reflect over it, then one doesn't get the full benefit of what one has heard and get it completely clear for oneself. So it's also important to think it over, analyze, ask questions, get one's doubts out and get them cleared up. So these 6 points make it possible to do that very thoroughly. So we're not just saying phenomena is phenomena and don't worry about it. We're saying 6 different things about phenomena to come in at it from every possible angle. And the reason that we're being so thorough is that the subject that we actually have to do with is what is to be given up in samsara. the way of introducing the nature of the phenomena that constitute samsara and are the very thing that is to be given up if one wants to get free of samsara. So it's a very serious study and very important for us. And if we approach that study using these 6 points, then it would be it to gain the sort of certainty that is needed to have a very effective way of approaching the problem of giving up samsara will be easy. The whole approach will be made easy for us. So, since there's such a significance in these 6 points, then the next question is, what are they? So the commentary then asks that point, what are these 6 ways of approaching phenomena? The first of them is called the tseni, the defining characteristics. Korwe chuji tseni, jitao yinpa shepar sawa la jupa. So one is introduced to an understanding of how the traits of phenomena which constitute samsara are. How are they defined? Then what is the rationale behind this definition? How can one understand it logically? That is also introduced, that's the second one. Then one investigates phenomena in pure being in terms of whether they are the same or different. And Rinpoche said, through investigating whether they're the same or different, one discovers that they are, that they transcend being the same or different. That was the third point, and the fourth is called the ground, meaning the ground of samsara. And you can understand that in two ways, actually. Either as what provides the kind of foundation on which samsara is built up, ground in that sense, or it could also, the way the subject is treated here, it could also mean ground of experience. So what is the ground of experience within the samsaric situation? And then that ground is analyzed from two perspectives. Experience which is shared in common with others and experience which is not common. So when it's extremely important in this context, since the teaching says there are no outer objects existing, then one has to address oneself to the question of what about common experience? If there is no mountain existing, why do I see it? Why does my child see it? Why does my mother see it? Why does my grandmother see it? Why does everybody see it? If it's not there. So that's why we take up this question of the ground which is shared in common and not shared in common. And first we have to distinguish even which areas of experience are common and not common, to even get close to them, to the subject. Then so those are the next 2 points, common and uncommon grounds. Then the sixth point is
the fourth, actually.
Well, the fourth includes both fourth and fifth.
Yeah. Okay.
Because ground is there's the common ground is the is one of them, and the uncommon ground is the other one. So then we get to the sixth, which is has again to do with, we have come full circle. We started with phenomena as meaning dualistic appearance, and we finished with an introduction to that which is beyond dualistic appearance. So, in the root verse it says that the lack of appearance involving perceiver perceived. So that is the sixth point in talking about phenomena. One starts out as point number one is defining phenomena in terms of dualistic appearance. And one ends up pointing out that to get a complete picture of phenomena, one has to go beyond dualistic appearance. One has to So I'll try to do this from the commentaries to in order to pick up what Rinpoche said also. So dualistic appearance is called a paradox, and it's the paradox of what does not exist appearing at the same time that it doesn't exist. And since that is a paradox which in itself has no essence, since the appearance cannot have an essence, since it's something not existing that appears. If we take the example of the dream, the flower in the dream has no existence, even though there is an appearance of a flower. There is no atom of a flower. So no matter how long you dream about the flower, this will not make it into atoms. Or how short you dream about it, whether you dream of it as a pleasant flower or as an unpleasant flower, a clean flower or dirty flower, whether you like it or don't, whether it causes you suffering or happiness, there's not a single atom of a flower. So there's no essence to the experience. And that's what is being introduced as the sixth point, that this paradoxical pair of the non-existent appearing does not exist that way. It is not present anywhere except as a thought. And there is something that one can be introduced to that goes beyond that paradox of dualistic appearance. So in other words, there is some basic mind out of which this confusion arises. The confusion of there being dualistic appearance arises out of a mind which itself is empty of dualism. So that's what Rinpoche was saying this many times. He repeated Dzungzin Nyingi Trungpa. Dzung is perceived, Zin is perceiver, Ni is dualism, Nang is appearance, and Trungpa is delusion. Dzungzin Nyingi Trungpa, the delusion of a dualistic appearance perceived in perceiver. And ultimate mind is Dzungzin Nyingi Shepa. Maybe we should write that on the board.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
So we put both sides of it on the board, the wrong side and the right side.
Wait, is that under which point is that?
It's under point six.
Under point six, okay.
Yeah. These are the first words that are important. Dzungzin Ni. And the whole difference between samsara and nirvana we can put in a very, very simple way here. Because it depends on what you do with Dzungzin Ni.
Do you have it or not?
first duality of the perceived and the perceiver?
Yeah, I'll go through word by word after. Zung is perceived. And Rinpoche often expands the phrase to see Zungwe Yul. See outer Zungwe perceived Yul object. Outer perceived object. Zin is Nang Zinpe Sem, inner perceiving mind. It's a very good way to learn Tibetan, because the way the Tibetan language functions, at least Dharma language, is each word is like a seed. So you can take one word like Zung, and then if it sprouts a little bit, then it looks like this. See Zungwe Yul, then it's got a little bit of leaves on it. Then this phrase sprouts and gets a little bigger, and then that one, and it keeps going like that. So if you start with the seeds, then you're inside the language where it's all coming from. Then at some point it's easy to follow the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Tied all together,
this is two different things, right?
Two different things.
So this first one is an expansion of the word Zung.
Okay.
And the second one is an expansion of Zin. So qi, or what is usually pronounced qi, is outer, and zungwa is perceived, and here in the Tibetan we need a connective particle, connecting it up with yul, the object. So outer perceived object, and nang, inner, Zinpe, perceiving, sim, mind. these are like the two of the central terms in the text. The first of them is for us in our deluded state, in a state of confusion that the mind is in samsara. It takes the sisum with you as being da, as having a da, a self. And self, that doesn't mean self like myself. It means like self-entity or essence. Mm-hmm. Right? So the fact that we think that there are objects existing on the outside means we think they have an essence. So if there is a flower, one thinks there is some kind of substance there constituting the flower. Sounds harmless enough. And because we think that the outside world is this stuff having an essence, which is really there and really out there and really coming from out there, then also we have the other problem, that we think that we have a self, that the inner perceiving mind, this is the personal self, right? So this is a much more subtle description of outside and inside than we usually hear, right?
What was the
object? Object.
So if the outside world has an essence and is really there, then also the inner perceiving mind has an essence and constitutes a true personal self. Because samsara is a delusion, then it's possible to correct it. If there really was an essence to things outside and an essence to the self inside, there would be no remedy. Then we would just have to suffer. Sorry about that. There wouldn't be any courses, there wouldn't be any meditations, there wouldn't be any of this exciting stuff. But fortunately, it doesn't have any essence. So we can do something about it if we know what's wrong very precisely. So the thing is that the whole process of samsara, yeah, thanks, centers in nangwa, right? Appearance. So there is an appearance of a dualism of perceived and perceiver. And what is this appearance? It is a trupa. Trupa is delusion, or it's also often translated as confusion. It basically just means being wrong. One has the wrong picture. So that's the samsara, and then nirvana is this other arrow. We start the same place, zunzin nir tong. Zunzin ni tong pe shepa, or tong di shepa. So tong means empty, and shepa is consciousness. The same word means to know. Yeah, the same word shepa can also mean to know, just in an ordinary sense.
But this applies to consciousness.
Yeah, here it's applying to the ultimate level of consciousness. When you say zumzin ni tongi shepa, that's the ultimate consciousness in the Citta Mata. So to translate that literally, the consciousness which is empty of a duality of perceived and perceiver. So if we look at this in terms of the dream example, what one is experiencing in the dream is this part, the delusion of appearance. For example, fire, being burned by fire. Why can we say it's a delusion? Because the fire doesn't exist, but appears. Why do we suffer from something that doesn't exist? Because we don't recognize it as a dream, so we think it exists. So.
Yeah.
Which part?
The second after the...
This part?
No,
this one.
Yep.
This is Trulpa. Trulpa.
The whole.
Nam means Trulpa.
And what did it mean?
Nam means appearance.
Yeah.
And Trulpa is delusion. The delusion of an appearance of the duality of perceived and perceived.
Lay Lao Lu.
So Rinpoche has given us something very, very brief today. And because it's so brief, it's very easy. We're almost finished already getting through it. And he's done this so that we would have the time to clear up any questions that there are about it and get any ideas out that you might have. If you have misunderstandings, then we should try to get to the bottom of them and get them solved. So then you have a chance to ask questions and do a debate, and so on.
Tanda
Sasong, tani dikapsu nampa drukki, says Allah, nampa druk di nang ne drupa de zungzin ni nang wa Allah. Ni nang wa mepa la jupa. So is this
no zonga neba no neela rapu
ke. So is this schema clear?
Yeah.
How is it clear how this one refers to ultimate mind? So Rinpoche said, in approaching this subject, we shouldn't think about things very far away and try to understand those, but to take appearances that we are experiencing right now and try to understand dualistic appearance in terms of what is appearing to us at this very instant, and also try to understand the lack of something perceived, any perceiver, in terms of what we're experiencing now.
Perceived. Zimba.
Zimba. Perceiver.
Perceiver. Perceive.
So we should,
in this term of the absolute mind,
yes,
the absolute state,
yeah,
as you say it here, it's like this lack of perceive, this duality of perceiver is something existed.
Yes.
Is this the way you...
Yes, that's the expression of genuine reality. Mm-hmm. The
zumzini pongi shepa. So that consciousness which is empty of duality of perceptive perceiver is genuine reality. That's what really exists.
Is it consciousness?
Well, that's the Chittamatan term, consciousness. Other levels of the teaching wouldn't use the term consciousness there. They would, for example, use rigpa, awareness. But in Chittamatra, it's called shepa. Yeah, there's a, Rinpoche said there's a great connection, a strong connection between the different levels of view, and especially between the Chittamatran view that we're hearing here and the Shentong Madhyamaka. There's a strong connection between those two. And through having gone through all the different levels of the view systematically as you've done, and now coming back and looking at this very thoroughgoing introduction to the Chittamatran view, then the connection there is between the Chittamatran and the Shentong Madhyamaka will become very clear to you. So we're finished with going through what Rinpoche presented, and we can continue with whatever questions you might have.
Whatever
questions, yes. Or whatever needs to be cleared up.
It is not a question. It doesn't have to be a question about this one. The topic is the same, but it's not from this text. We had it today in the group with Jana.
Yeah. We can try to take it up. Yeah, we can try to take it up. If it turns out not to be closely enough associated, then we'll have to drop it. But try. Let's see if it fits in.
Yeah. Well, it was the same as Chittamatran and Shentong, and you talk about Shentong and emptiness. And there is this saying that the wisdom mind has to be pointed out to the to the disciple by the guru, and I thought this was the same with emptiness. And Jana said emptiness can be worked towards without the pointing out by the guru.
Yeah, that's true in the Sutrayana tradition,
yes.
Which is that tradition in which the teachings on emptiness were given originally. One has a very strong and a long tradition of logical analysis. Mm-hmm. So it is possible through one's own efforts to conduct a logical analysis of the emptiness and come to the right conclusion. It's unlikely that one would do it properly without a teacher. I mean, in practice, one needs a teacher even for that level. But theoretically, it would be possible using your own logic alone to analyze it properly and come to the right conclusion. But even in the Mahayana, one has traditionally placed a great importance on the role of the teacher. Not as strong an importance as it has in the Vajrayana. But the special role of the teacher in the Sutrayana context is not so much the logical part of it, that one has to do oneself. But the teacher's role there is mainly to point out to oneself how the idea of self applies in your own case. You know, what your own concepts are, what sort of concepts you are trapped in.
Yes.
You know, it's very difficult to see that what one's own concepts are. Mm-hmm. And one's own ego attachment. Right? Mm-hmm. It's difficult to even see it, to even recognize it. So the teacher is always holding this mirror up, you know, in different ways, showing oneself what one's own ego attachment is. So in practice, the teacher is very important, even in also in the Sutrayana tradition. But then, are there any questions about how this fits together, of how to understand the argument? Or
which argument?
The ones that we've had up till now. I mean, the main statement that we've had.
No, I was wondering if you could, the six ways of approaching this, if you can explain it, give a commentary on your translation.
The translation?
Yeah.
Like, what do all these words mean?
Yeah, exactly. because you said investigate for the third one, and actually here you wrote the approach entailing knowledge. So if you could, you could just give a short commentary on that.
Okay.
On those 6 points.
Which page is that on?
That's page 11.
Okay. Page 11.
It's actually starting page 10,
huh? Yeah, the root text is down on page 10. And then the commentary is at the top of 11. Yeah, the six ways of approaching this are as follows. The approach which involves knowing precisely how the characteristics of samsaric phenomena are defined. So, the idea is that if you don't know the characteristic of a thing, then you haven't even met it. You know, you're not anywhere near it. You can't think about it. You know, concepts work with characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. So
when you say characteristics now,
yeah.
I mean, there's a kind of emptiness. We say thing is a kind of non-existence. When we say thing does not exist according to its own characteristics.
Yeah, doesn't exist with its own characteristics.
That's,
yeah.
I mean, that's for the imaginary nature.
Yeah.
You said that it doesn't exist. I mean, it's more of non-existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't exist according to its own characteristics. And for example, there's that fire and brim.
Yeah.
That it doesn't come.
Right. Yeah, so an example of a characteristic would be the characteristics of fire are heat and burning, right?
You see, I have a problem now connecting. I mean, I can understand how it doesn't exist according to its own characteristics in the drink.
Mm.
But what about not in the drink?
Well, the...
I mean, how it doesn't exist according to its own characteristics, if it has characteristics, and these are one of them here.
Yeah.
Is this related to what she's talking about?
Oh.
Yeah, because
I'm trying to figure out how it relates to
him. It relates to the word characteristic, right?
Oh, okay.
So from these 6 points, the first one is the characteristics of phenomena. So we're taking up this word characteristic and going deeper into it, right? And saying if you take a simple example of something with characteristics, then fire would be a good one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is traditionally, the characteristics of that in Tibetan are defined as heat and burning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that definition comes from common experience, from the ordinary way of perceiving it. All of the definitions in logical debate come from the Sautantrika school. The Sautantrika school were Hinayanists. That means that they had the view that outer objects existed, right? And therefore, they defined them as if they exist. So the definitions are all from that perspective, as if fire exists. Well. This is a very difficult subject. There are different ways of approaching it. One of it would be to go in terms of the atoms and say, if the object is there, existing, composed of atoms, then there would be a base for those characteristics, right? There would be a solid base or a real base for the characteristics that it seems to be demonstrating. So one of the...
like the smoke of the fire.
Yeah, if we take the fire as the example, then if the fire is real, then it must have an atomic construction. It's made up of atoms. And if it's made up of atoms that truly exist, then these atoms cannot be divisible. Because if it's truly existent, you can't change it. Right? This is part of the idea of truly existent, that it is what it is. So it's not, you can't, doesn't change into something else. Right?
Because then it's not fire.
Yeah, if it can change into something else, then it's not a thing, it's not something itself.
Well,
it's not something truly existent.
We have to define the word change.
Well, change means it becomes something it wasn't before.
Well, if it is all that, I mean, if the whole thing becomes something that it wasn't before, it is from change. To have change, if something remains the same, you know what I mean? I mean, this is a very
yeah, well, I think you're jumping a couple of steps ahead of where I've arrived at, I think.
You have to understand first this, what Jim says. I think it's important to have a definition of what we mean by existing.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to get a picture of that. Right? So let's take a model of existence as saying something that exists with atoms, because then it would be a thing, right? And if it's going to be not only a thing, but a real thing, something which is only that, right? Because if it's something, if it becomes something else, then it's not a real thing. This part of it has to be clear, otherwise we can't go on. Right? And it's very subtle, but as soon as it stops being what it was when you first met it, then you can't talk of it as a real thing, if you can change its state.
This is an axiom.
Yes.
Well, it's the definition. Yeah. If it's real, then it is what it is. It can't be something else, right?
It's non-changing, it's changeless. It has to
yeah.
Be changeless.
If fire is truly existent, then it has to be demonstrating those characteristics at any and all times without those characteristics being changeable. If the changeable is not real, right?
Well, this is why I wasn't actually jumping, because here I come with change. It depends how you define change, because you may define that change in the intensity.
No.
As change in the quality and the
well,
quantity.
Any so change.
Your definition of existence, you exclude everything. But this is by your definition, you don't prove that you. But your definition of existence is impossible.
Well, what definition of reality can you have except that it's real? And what do you mean by real except that it is what it is? And if it is what it is, it can't be something else, right? It's just that.
No.
I mean, if it's fire...
this is not... you don't have to accept that.
Well, then what's your idea of real? That it can be something else also?
It doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't change. It can be changed. The fact is not what is there, but the fact that something is there. You see, I mean, the problem is not...
Well, now you're talking about something. We're talking about fire. So if fire, having the characteristics of heat and burning, is real, then it must be that. It must be this thing being hot and burning, it can't be something else.
I mean,
like it can't be stopped by water.
Fire,
you know, if you have fire here and you put water on top of it and it disappears, then it wasn't real.
Yeah.
I don't mean not necessarily.
Because if it's real, it can't change. You can't make it into something which is not. It's not really, it's common sense, right? This is a common way of understanding it.
Yeah,
you know, either it is that or it's not, right? If it's real.
Yes, but
it can't both be that and not be it. Yes, and it can't be at sometimes and not sometimes.
Oh, why not that? This is what I meant. It can be for a limited time, in a limited place, and in a certain amount, and it can be in a different amount.
Okay, so you're defining now relative phenomena, not real phenomena. So you're agreeing with me now.
Well, maybe you're
right. You're agreeing with the... But you're now taking the Buddhist position that things change.
No, just the ones
that change are relative.
Yeah, and as soon as there's change, we're talking about relative, right? Not real.
Like trees, for example. Well,
it depends what you, I mean, we see them.
Yeah, trees.
We have no experience of real. There is nothing, I don't understand, if you define real like that, I cannot relate to it because I have no example of what you're saying as real.
Yeah.
Space is an example in ordinary terms.
Yeah. For relative people to understand, space is the example.
Yeah, it's the example of something unchanging that one can easily understand. And, I mean, in the Indian tradition, the way self was defined, for example, is it has to be single, unchanging, permanent, and so on, all these characteristics. Existing on its own, from its own side.
Yeah, and now we're talking about, for example, atomic physics.
Yeah, but so we have to keep going back to self, because if the fire is real, then it has a self. It has a self-entity, an essence. Mm-hmm. It has a substantial essence constituting it for what it is. And if that is real, it cannot be dependent on something else. It exists within itself, it rests in itself, it comes from itself. It doesn't come from causes and conditions. It has to be what it is by its own power. Right? And it has to always be that. Because if it's not always that, then it's only sometimes, and then it's not real. It's not a truly existent phenomenon.
So the only real example we can have is space.
Well, that's one of them. I don't know. There might be others, but that's certainly one of them. So, in fact, we have most of the picture already clear now, I think.
In the six ways. I just wanted an explanation of your wording.
Well, we're going through the wording. One of the words is characteristic.
Okay.
And this was now the explanation of the imaginary image.
Yes, that was the right.
But if you say that the fire exhausts, I mean it exhausts because there's no food anymore. No more wood or something. No?
Yes.
But is this not a dependent?
Yeah, that would be a dependent kind of phenomenon. Which is another way of refuting it as being truly existent. Since it depends for its existence not on its own characteristics, but on other things. In order to even seem to exist, it depends on other things. So it has no true existence of its own. How can we say it? It's something that it's so simple that it's difficult to catch it. You know, one has to think it through again and again and again, because what is being said is extremely simple, in fact. But I never actually got to go through the argument about the atoms, because we got off on trying to define the terms of real and unreal. Right? But now I think we have an agreement that in order to talk about an atom as being real, then it also has to be something indivisible. You can't change it in any way. You can't break it up into two, because then it's not an atom, it's two atoms. So if we're going to talk about an atom at all, we have to find one that you can't break down, right? And this is not possible. It's not possible physically, it's not possible logically. Physically, you can always break them down further and further. And logically, you can always break them down further and further. And in fact, the Sautantrikas go through a thought experiment for what would happen if it wasn't like that. If you actually found the smallest particle, the smallest atom, and it would have to be partless.
Yeah.
Because only something partless can't be broken down. So we're now in this paradoxical situation of saying everything is composed of parts which in their most elementary state have no parts. So it's already a contradiction.
Are you using the word geometry, the definition of the dot, then the whole three-dimensional world collapses.
Yes.
So the dot is something that has no dimension.
Has no dimension.
And then make a line from the dot, and the line has only one dimension.
Yes, it's a similar example, and if we take the argument out to the end, so we start with saying things do not exist with their own characteristics. Right? What do you mean by that? Well, let's take a thing with the characteristic of heat and burning, like fire. If it really exists with those characteristics, then it must have atoms, must have some kind of parts it exists with. If you go looking for those parts, they break down further and further and further until you get to the partless particle. And if that particle is really going to be an atom, some kind of a physical object, it has to be able to go into relation with other physical objects. Otherwise, it makes no sense to talk about it as a physical object. Right? So this partless part we got down to as the tiniest atom has to relate to other things in different directions. So that means that if we take this, let's say this partless atom is here, then to the north of it there will be a part, to the south, to the north and west, and above and below. So it turns out that the partless particle has to have at least six sides. If it doesn't have six sides, then it can't relate to anything. Then it would mean that the whole universe was one atom. That one single partless particle was the entire universe. In which case, there would be no explanation of why things can move. Because it would all be the same atom. There would be no movement of one part in relation to another.
Can you imagine that?
So we refute the existence of the partless particle. It's not even logically possible. And that means that the tiniest atom, there's no such thing as the smallest atom. The only thing we have left are the type of atoms that break down further and further. And since those are all changeable, they're not real. So we don't find anything constituting the object that has a solid essence, an unchangeable essence, making it real. So that, since the object is not there with an essence of its own, then those characteristics that it's demonstrating are also not properties of itself, because there's no self. It itself is not there. So what are those characteristics? They're just being borrowed from the surroundings. You know, they're dependent on other things. So the heat and burning of the fire is actually coming from the process of breaking down something else, breaking down the wood or the paper or whatever is burning. It's not a characteristic belonging to an object called fire.
Oh, isn't this nice? I thought it was always given like, you know, running. Exactly that, that fire and heat is inseparable.
Yeah, well, that's the Sautantrika argument.
Yes.
Because they were thinking of things as truly existent. And they're the ones who have the argument about the partless particle, right? That they say that things are made up of partless particles.
But they're beyond atoms.
No, it's not in that.
No, it's another school that comes and refutes the Sautantrikas.
But it's
that's the Chittamatran school refutes the Sautantrikas.
This is also given as that the Buddha nature has qualities and these are inseparable.
Oh, that's a completely different level of explanation.
Hmm?
That's a completely different, that's in a different realm completely from what we're talking about now. It's a completely different discussion.
Okay.
I think it would be misleading to get into that at this point, because it doesn't have anything to do with what we're at right now. But is that enough to kind of give a picture that that even though we talk about, conventionally speaking, we talk about phenomena as having their own characteristics, but in fact they don't have their own characteristics. But we start out assuming they have, and say, okay, what are the characteristics of phenomena? Then they're defined, right? So that's the first point.
Can I ask something on that? I mean, does this discussion leave us with... I mean, have we refuted the fact that something is there? I mean, it cannot be... Well, no, it's not fire. It's not something. It's not... but is there something?
Can we just get through this first and then ask the question afterwards? I really would like to get through this part, because then it's going to hurry up and maybe the answer's in him explaining this.
Yeah, the answer is completely, it goes together with this. That's can say it that way. The something that exists is in the sixth point. So we'll get to that. So the second one is the approach entailing knowledge of the sense in which phenomena and their pure being are neither the same nor different. So in other words, one goes through the arguments that we went through yesterday, and when one's understood the argument, then one knows in what sense phenomena and pure being are neither different nor the same. So that's all that means. So what was the argument? Now somebody else can talk for a while. Why are phenomena and pure being not the same?
Why are they not the same?
Yeah, why they're not the same, or in other words, why they're different?
Because in the first case, in the phenomena world, we have the appearance of self and of dualism. Somebody who perceives and the perceived object, and in the second and labeling also given name, and in the second we have the lack of it.
Yeah, can say it that way. That pure being. It does not have those properties of being a perceiver and perceived, whereas phenomena do have them. So that's one way they're different. The way that the text put it was that the if you want to go to the bottom of the whole thing and saying the most fundamental difference between phenomena and pure being is that pure being exists and phenomena do not. So that again answers your question about is there something? And the something that exists is pure being. And the something which exists has existed from the beginning as naturally pure nirvana, is the way it's described in the text. The naturally present fundamental mind. And what doesn't exist is the apparent duality of perceived and perceiver. We haven't gone through the arguments yet for why that doesn't exist, so it's a little bit unclear at this point why it doesn't exist. So we have that still as a question. Maybe somebody will conduct a debate from that angle.
But wasn't that her debate? Trying to find out why it didn't exist?
Yeah, it was an attempt at...
What's wrong?
Yeah. That would be one way of going into it. Yeah, I mean, it's almost any scientist could use the same argument. Obviously, things exist because they have their own characteristics. But we just went through that argument for why that doesn't hold up. So then there was the other argument, there were three different arguments given for why they are not different. So we had now why pure being and phenomena are not the same, then why are they not different? There were three reasons. Yeah, why they're not two different things. Different means completely separate things.
Yeah, because if we put out what it is not in the phenomenon, the duality, what is left is the pure being.
Yeah, so they're not two different things.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, the way it's put in the text is the same thing you're saying, that pure being is just a way of saying the lack of always exists simultaneously. You never get pure being over here and a phenomenon over here.
you never get pure being alone.
Never get it alone.
No, because it's not really existing.
Well, up to here, at this level, it is really existing.
For the Chitta mantra.
Yes, this is what I'm talking about. Well, it is really existing.
It's truly, yeah, it's... In fact, the Chitta mantra say is truly existent.
Yeah.
So that's different from real.
No, it's the same as real.
It's the same.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That pure being is truly existent.
Yeah, the Chitta mantra school says that. And then the Madhyamaka comes and refutes the true existence of that of the consciousness empty of duality of perceived and perceived. Perceiver. The Madhyamaka says, the Rongtong school says that as soon as you posit true existence of this consciousness, then you're off into a wrong view again. For example, you know, if you take the experience of being carried away by water in a dream, the fact that there is an appearance and there's the delusion of the water as being real, then one can have the suffering of being drowned in the water. But as soon as you recognize that it's a dream, then you see that mind which was experiencing that was empty of that water. The mind experiencing being drowned in the water was empty of any water or someone being drowned in it. So it's in a very, very simple way that these terms are meant. They sound very, very complicated. Consciousness empty of duality, of perceived and perceiver. It sounds very heavy. Huh? But it just means that in that instant in the dream, when you think, oh, I'm dreaming, then you see the water is not there, and the one being drowned in the water is not there. That's the duality. And that mind, which is empty of water and someone being drowned, is the ultimate mind. And its ultimate is it's genuinely real. That is what is there. That mind, having the experience of being drowned in the water, but actually being empty of either the water or the experience of being drowned. That mind is real. Is real. That is genuine reality.
That's pure being?
That's pure being, yeah.
But if you didn't have pure being, then you wouldn't have the illusion of perceiving.
The suffering.
Exactly. If there was no mind there at all.
There wouldn't be any.
Because this mind is consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. And consciousness is conscious of something. Right? So we're back to appearance, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is not that there is appearance. The problem is the delusion of thinking that the appearance is real, because one doesn't recognize it's a dreamlike appearance. You know, as soon as you recognize it's a dream, then you can carry on with the dream. It doesn't matter, you know, it's not hurting anybody. You can lie there the whole night and dream you'd be drowning in water if you want to. As long as you know it's a dream. Nobody's asking you to stop it. But only to be aware that it is a dream, that it's not real water.
So the illusion of the dream and water is phenomena, and then when you wake up, that's the pure being.
And not necessarily when you wake up, but when you recognize it's a dream.
When you recognize it's a pure being.
When you recognize it's a dream, then it's like catching a glimpse of that consciousness empty of the duality of perceiver and perceiver. So that's what was meant by the second one. Then the third one was the approach involving knowledge of samsara's common ground. That one we haven't gone into yet.
Isn't that the fourth?
Yeah, it's the fourth, yeah. So the fourth, fifth, and sixth, we haven't gone into the details of them yet. So there's nothing really to explain there yet. So I think we got it all, unless there are other ways you want to attack this, or questions. It's very useful to try to analyze it and try to find a hole and try to find a way that it doesn't hold up, because then you understand it better afterwards.
Would the imaginary nature of the fire be, is it that you call it fire?
Yeah, that we put on the name fire, and also that we think of the fire as existing exteriorly, as it being something exterior to consciousness. It corresponds to, in the dream, thinking that the fire is a really outer fire. Mm-hmm. It's a complete imputation. Right?
And what is the difference to the dependent nature?
The dependent nature exists in a relative sense. So the fact that the image of fire arises in your mind in the dream is a dependent factor, because that arises due to the habitual tendency stored in the mind, which produce the image. So that is dependent on something for its arising, so it's called the dependent aspect. Right?
And
it's there, relatively speaking. Right?
And the will, I mean, fire not in a dream, is dependent also upon mind in this definition, or it depends upon conditions like pool and air?
Well, that's a very, very tricky point, to try to go from the dream to the waking state. But the thing is that the dream is the example of what's happening in the waking state. So it's trying to tell us that the way things are in the dream is also the way they are in the waking state. But it's much more difficult to see it in the waking state.
Can we take an example and say the imaginary nature, the imaginary quality, the dependent quality, the imaginary nature, the dependent nature is this? Can we take an example like the fire?
Yeah,
the fire not in a dream. What's mm-hmm. the real?
Yeah. Okay, we can take real fire. Like, do you mean German fire or Greek fire?
Let's go out and
have a
fire and talk about it.
So it's not a fire of the north or of the east or the west or the south. It's not a fire of the past or the present or the future. I mean, I'm trying to find this fire you're talking about.
Right, so that's the imaginary nature.
Yeah, so that's the imaginary nature. The fact that we think it exists somewhere at all is the imaginary nature. The fact that we think it exists somewhere, a real fire, man.
Would things still exist if it was a fire and it didn't change at all, let's say? But time went on, so doesn't that change? How does it make it all?
Yeah, after some time goes, then the fire goes out, right? But maybe that.
Yeah,
maybe I didn't catch what you meant. But it's true, if we take that angle up, if we could find a fire that's perpetual, you know, it always keeps burning, then we would have found real fire and we could all go and be burnt by it and really suffer.
But how is that? How could we really,
how is it that we don't find a real fire?
I mean, let's say if we could,
if we could, then it would mean that the fire existed by the power of its own characteristics. It wouldn't need something else to make those characteristics happen.
Okay.
So it would be hot and burning by itself,
without
needing any wood or any fuel or anything. So that it would be unchanging and permanent.
But just the fact that it needs oxygen, right?
The fact that it needs oxygen, yeah.
Is therefore not even existent. I mean,
it shows that it's a relative phenomenon, dependent on
cause
and condition.
Because when the ozone layer puts all that carbon dioxide.
It's many things together, we give a name.
it's foxes and woods. So like we say, this is
what's the dependent of nature?
The dependent characteristic for fire would be the fuel that it depends on. You know,
the conditions.
The conditions that produce it.
The dependent nature are the conditions?
Yeah, the dependent nature is that set of conditions that produces it.
And dependent nature can also be dependent characteristics?
Well, dependent nature means that aspect of the phenomena which arises in dependence on something. Right, that's so the name dependence is given to that.
Okay.
The fact that the existence of the fire depends on the conditions creating it, that's the dependent aspect of the fire.
And this one dependent aspect is as well that there is someone who perceives the fire.
This is where the idea of names comes in, because fire doesn't exist anywhere, that's just a name. Right.
Yes.
So to be using a name like fire, then there has to be a mind connected with it.
No, it just thinks he's talking about the receptor.
Yes, someone perceiving
the
fire.
Perceiving.
I mean,
perceiving
if I perceive fire, I need the object, fire.
So actually,
someone who perceives
it.
Yes.
And these two, this is also the dependent nature of fire, that there's fire.
Yes, because actually you can have a fire without somebody who's perceiving the fire.
Because actually there may be one, but we don't know about it because we're here and we don't see it, right?
In which case we wouldn't call it fire because we don't know anything about it. Yeah. So things that don't appear to the mind can't be evaluated. You know, we can't analyze them or anything. So they're not a genuine case we can take up. It has to be something that appears to the mind.
Can you give the Tibetan words for imaginary and dependent?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
They're much nicer than the English words.
Oh, great. And what you translate? The imaginary and dependent, and then there's another one, three. If you could just give them all three,
Do you use imputation for imaginary sometimes when you refer
to it? I like the imputed nature better, because even though it's more scholastic, it's more intellectual, but it's more precise.
I think imaginary is confusing. I mean, it is confusing to me, imaginary.
Yeah. Yeah, and for me, imaginary is something positive, mainly. Right?
I
imagination
was
is a positive thing in my mind, right? So I don't like to use that name for describing this.
And imaginary imputed, isn't that different almost? Isn't imaginary imputed?
Well, they can mean the same thing, that you're making it up. You're sticking it out there as if it was there.